Morning, church. Oh, me. It is good to be here this morning. It's good to be with you all this morning, as always. Our Sunday morning time is such a blessing, to not only for me, but for my family and for really this whole congregation. I am thankful to be a part of this church. Now, we've got something that we need to do really quick. I took up this last Sunday. I took up and passed out these sign-up sheets for small groups. Now, many of you signed up. In fact, we had, last Sunday alone, we had 60 families sign up to be a part of small groups. Raise your hand if you turned in a form last Sunday. Just raise them up. Well, there were 60, trust me. Now, this Sunday, some of you who were not here last Sunday, or some of you who may have gone home and repented and still want to do this, we want everybody who's a part of the Forest Mill Church to be a part of small groups, regardless of your age, regardless of where you live. We want to make this an experience because we think it's important as you grow in your relationships, not just with one another, but in your relationship to God, to have a group of Christians with whom you can share share your life and with whom you can share your strength as well. So we want to do that. We've got some young men who are going to come around now. They've got some forms to pass out. Here's some extras. I forgot to give you guys these. If you have not filled out one of these yet and need to get one, just raise your hand. They're going to be making their way around. Just raise your hands. Okay. Small groups, some of you think that the idea of being in a small group sounds like a terrible idea, and you have zero desire. You have zero desire to do that and to be a leader or a part of a group that where you share your life and you share kind of what's going on with you and your family. But that is actually a really important part of your spiritual walk. You're going to have to forgive me for just a second. I taught the high school class this morning, and I am completely out of sorts. I had the high school lesson still pulled up on my thing here, and so I'm kind of winging it. Which, for you out there and for me up here, being in front of the people you need to talk to without knowing what you're going to say, that's kind of a definition of hell. I mean, that is, conveniently enough, what we're talking about this morning. We're going to talk about hell. So here's the question that we need to start off with. What is hell? And this one's open for discussion. If you think you know what hell is, or if you want to give a brief description, I am open to it this morning. Let's begin with the question, what is hell? Where God is not. Eternal torture? Purgatory? What's that? Total darkness? Yeah. Fire. Good answer, Slade. Yes. What? Slavery? Oh, wow. Some great answers for what is hell, Ronnie? Eternal separation from the Almighty. All good answers. Well, let me, when I think about hell, and this was growing up, I remember when I was in a class, a Bible class on Sunday morning, and my teacher started talking about hell, and it scared me to death. She was talking about how hot and how dark it was going to be and all that. And I pictured a time when I was younger, where my brother and I had been playing soccer in the front yard. And our ball had rolled into the culvert beneath our driveway. And it was not very big. It's the middle of summer in East Texas. It was warm, you know. So I was thinking, I remember crawling into that culvert in the middle of a day in July or whenever it was, and inching my way along, and how hot it was in there and how it got dark really quickly once you got to the middle of our driveway, which was pretty wide, and I couldn't move. And then I came up on a bed of fire ants. And so that was hell. That was hell for me. I don't know why I thought that was a good way to get the ball out of there, but that's what I was doing. I remember I couldn't move. You're in this concrete culvert, and it's hot, and it's dark, and then pain. That was, to me, my mind of hell. And so as she talked, I pictured in my mind something that looked like this. Is anybody that close to anybody's picture of hell? Just me. Okay, well, good. I'm glad I drew that this week. But lake of fire, you got people who are writhing in agony. You've got never-ending torture, which someone mentioned. And let me state now up front that I disagree with this view. It's not really a popular view, but that I disagree with this view with hell. I believe that hell is not never-ending torture. I don't think that hell is never-ending torture, but I believe that hell is what Jesus refers to as the destruction of the soul, or what Revelation calls the second death. I think it is ceasing to exist. That's honestly what I think about hell. But you may agree with me, you may disagree with me. That's not the topic of the sermon this morning. For the purposes of our lesson this morning, either view is fine. Whatever you think about hell, it's awful. Either one of those scenarios is terrible. But both views put God squarely in the crosshairs of our judgment. We're trying to figure out, this is kind of the core question. It's a question that's become a real stumbling block for many in our culture today. And I'll say that's the caveat, that this is a huge stumbling block for a lot of people in our culture today. And here's the question. How could a loving God send people to hell? Right? How could a loving God send people to hell? We understand the concept of punishment. I'm a dad. Maybe many of you have been parents, or if you weren't parents, you were at least kids, so you understand the concept of punishment. And though we don't like to experience punishment personally, I can appreciate the benefits in retrospect of having been corrected. I mean, I'd been a total tyrant if my parents had not punished me or disciplined me. But eternal punishment? I mean, isn't that excessive to the extreme? If you had a father who eternally punished their child today, you know, just imagine that my child has done something and I'm going to punish him forever. And not just punish like a whip in a day or confined to his room, but never-ending torture for eternity. And that's the most popular view of hell, is what hell is never-ending torture for eternity. If that is your view of God, doesn't that make God sound like a tyrant? Like a abusive father? And so it's no wonder that this has become such a stumbling block. What kind of loving father would punish his children forever with torture? It just doesn't sound like the act of a loving God. Now, this question, it's such an antithesis of what a loving father is to us. I mean, this doesn't make any sense at all. And so this question resonates with so many who are sitting here this morning, not just people who are out there vaguely in our world or in our culture, but this is probably resonating with you, with me, because this goes against our ideas of what is just, what is fair, and it has become a huge obstacle of faith for even for many believers, but especially for unbelievers. Like, this is a complete barrier to faith for many who are not already believers, but even for many of us who are believers, it's at the very least a nagging question, right? So much so, I mean, like, this is such a hard question that we find it shocking to discover that this has not always been the case. Like, this has not always been an obstacle. In fact, it's still not an obstacle for much of the world. This question doesn't bother most of the world. This question doesn't bother the historical world. And so the other people who are not you and me and think differently than you and me, they're a lot more likely to have difficulty with a God who is forgiving. Because to them, And that's the very thing, by the way, we love the most about God. That's the thing that we talk the most, first and foremost about God, about how forgiving God is. But that's what they find is so offensive. You know, a God who teaches turn the other cheek and forgiveness of enemies, that offends their sense of what is right and just. That's not right to just let the people who are guilty off the hook. So why do we have these two hugely different mindsets? You've got many of us who are over here think, how could a loving God send people to hell? And you got people over here that are like, how could a righteous God forgive people? How do we have these two different mindsets? Well, the answer is that the difference has to do with being modern. You and I are thoroughly and completely and totally modern. Now, you may say, but I'm, 80 years old, or in some places, Miss Kathleen Hennessy's 90-something years old, right? And you say, how could I be modern? But compared to the rest of the world, and certainly compared to the history of the world, we are still really modern. In the ancient world, we're going to do this a little comparison here. In the ancient world, they believed that there was this moral order built into the fabric of the world. We look at the world, we say, oh, there's a physical order. You know, if you add this element plus this element, you get this compound. You get this compound, you get this. We figured out the whole chemical and physical reactions that take place that comprise our world. And we break everything down. We understand there's a physical order to the world, but they understood that there was a moral order to the world that was just as certain as anything physical. And that if you violated this moral order of the world, that you would experience pain the same way that if you violated the physical order and stuck your hand in a fire, you'd get burned. Right? You break the moral order of the world, and it hurts, and there are painful consequences the same way as if you violate the physical, right? That makes sense. Well, that was how they imagined. So that they believed that the pathway to wisdom was to figure out, to learn the moral order of the world, and then sort of conform yourself to it. You learned how the world operated, what the laws were, the same way we learned the law of gravity or the law of inertia or centripetal force. We learned those, and we figure out how to walk and stand up and move around in society. Well, you needed to learn this moral order in order to move. And that once you learned that, you kind of conformed to it and you adjusted to it, and that's how you lived. Now, we are the exact opposite. We are modern. A modern world, we can just completely reverse this. We see the world as entirely natural, like there's nothing supernatural out there. Even for those of us who are believers, we generally believe that the world is entirely natural. So, everything that's natural, it's kind of flexible. So instead of changing ourselves to fit our world, what we do is we change our world to fit ourselves. What temperature are you comfortable at? 72 degrees, somewhere thereabouts? Some of you are like, I need an Afghan at 72, and other of you, I need to take off a shirt at 72, but generally, right around 72, right? What temperature we keep it in here? Because you know what? I like it to be 72, so let's just make it 72. How many of you keep your house temperature around where you like it? How many of you do that? Just raise your hand. Huh. How about that? I want the world to be a certain temperature, therefore my world is a certain temperature. Isn't that crazy? The ancients would have thought our mindset was just fantastic. I mean, unbelievable, even crazy. We can change our world to fit ourselves. I do not want to know devastating news that's going on in the world a week from now. Right? So I want to get it right now. I've got this little thing on my phone. I don't even know how it got on there. But if something big happens, I find out like right away. We want our news instantly. So guess what? We get our news instantly. I want my food fast. I can go down the road and I can get a hamburger in 5 minutes, can't I? I don't have to make buns. I don't have to kill cows and grind up meat. I just go and get a hamburger. Right? So we get to order our world the way that we think it ought to work. But to the ancients, that just didn't make any sense. So, you got the two different ways to think. Suppose there's an anxious person. Someone who's anxious about what's going on. And they're here in the middle. An ancient person would look at an anxious person. A person from thousands of years ago would look at an anxious person. And they would say, you need to adjust yourself to the world, to the way the world is. You know, they would prescribe some spiritual character change. The reason you are so anxious is because you have unrealistic expectations. You need to adjust to the way the world is, and therefore you'll be less anxious. That's what they would say. What we would say is, no, you just need to change your world where you can handle it better. We would call it stress management techniques. They would say, change your expectations about the way the world is. We didn't say, change your world to fit your expectations. Does that make sense? So we get this difference between ancient and modern. So all of a sudden we come here to the modern world, to you and I. We're used to changing our world to suit ourselves. And we've gotten so good at it, we've got this sort of expectations built in. We get to determine what's right and what's wrong, what's good and what's bad. And with this newfound confidence, we think we ought to be able to control not just the physical world, we think we ought to be able to control the metaphysical world too, the spiritual world, that it ought to follow what we think is good too. So if it seems unfair to us, then it ought not to happen. Now to the ancients, this was crazy. This was like, you don't even get a say-so in this. What makes you think that you get to determine whether the afterlife is good or bad or long or short or painful or pleasurable? You don't get a say-so, and that's just the way the world is. I don't get to determine if fire is hot. I don't get to determine if the sun rises. I don't get to determine what the temperature in my home is all year long. Why would you get to determine what the afterlife is? That's just a waste of time. But to you and I, this is why we decide it thinks it sounds unfair. So if I decide, and this is many in our culture, if I decide that sex outside of marriage is okay, I would have my sense of justice affronted to later be judged guilty for that. Does that make sense? If I get to determine that, to have a God come along after me and say he's going to punish me for that, that doesn't make any sense to us. So this is why we find hell so offensive. It's because we think we get to determine whether it's offensive or not. Right? We think we ought to have a say-so in it. So that's why we find it so offensive, but it still doesn't answer the question. The question that's kind of behind all of this as to the how a loving God can send people to hell. And to deal with that, we've got to kind of look at the problem of evil. This is the way we think of hell. We think of hell that it works this way. That God gives us some time, and we make some bad decisions, and God gives us some more time, and we don't do anything about it, and then time's up. And then God sends people, or sends us, you know, at the end of our lives, he casts our souls into hell for all eternity. We cry out for mercy, but God says, no, 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 you've had your chance, your time's up, sorry, clock ran out, now you're going to suffer. That's generally the way we think hell works. Right? This is yes. Is that the way you think hell works? Most of us? Yeah, that's the way most of us think our hell works. But I want us to think just for a moment about the nature of evil. The biblical picture of sin, which some of you brought up in our definition of hell, was that sin separates us from the presence of God. That's what sin does. Sin separates us from the nature and from the presence of God. We see the damage that sin does. We know that it causes harm, but it's not just that it does harm in and of itself. It's not just that murder takes a life, but it does damage far beyond the person whose life was taken. It's not just that stealing or lying or cheating or blasphemy or idolatry or any of those things, it's not just that they do damage to that person at that time, but they create this rift between people and God. Like, they create separation between us and God. The source of all joy, the source of all love, the source of all wisdom, the source of all good things. God is the source of every bit of that, right? And so when we sin, we separate ourselves a little bit further and further away from that, which is why sin never brings us ultimately joy. We can have a temporary happiness and may feel good about it for a little bit and may even reap some sort of rewards about it right now. But in the end, it is a desperate state. Right? I can lie and cheat people in town for a while and my business may thrive. Eventually, I might get run out of town on a rail because my practices get found out. I can have my wife and have a little thing on the side too, have my cake and eat it too. My wife finds out and I'm in big trouble. We all know that there are physical and moral consequences for our sin. And that ultimately that sin does not bring us joy and peace and happiness on a biblical scale. That all good things come from God and sin separates us from God. So, because we're made in God's image, it's only in God's presence that we thrive and we flourish. If we were to lose completely that presence, that would be hell. The loss of our ability to give or receive love or joy. Right? If that sin just kind of became bigger and bigger and bigger, eventually we would be in hell on earth. Do you know anybody who's been in a hell on earth? If you know anybody that's been at the bottom of the barrel in an addiction, their life is ruined, no job, nobody wants to be around them. They even look like hell on earth, don't they? We see that. We see that happen not just in drug addiction or alcohol addiction, but we see that in all sorts of ways. It manifests itself that people end up just at the bottom. They become so self-absorbed. So now let's ask ourselves the question. What if when we die, we don't end, but we're sort of allowed to complete the journey that we began? What if the afterlife is not this whole brand new thing, it's just the end of the road for where we were headed? That makes it sound very different, doesn't it? Like, you are headed in a direction right now, and you may think, I've got a public direction and a private direction, but no, you've just got one direction. You are headed in a direction right now. Every decision you make, every thought that you think, every word that you speak, every place that you go, how you handle your money, how you treat your spouse, how you treat the people at school or at work, everything you do is a direction, and that the afterlife is completing that direction. You just get to go where you were headed. In that sense, hell is kind of our own making. So let's take, for example, a person who is self-absorbed or self-centered. And we're going to use for an example the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. Many of you are familiar with that. Lazarus is this poor man. He begs at the gate of a rich man, and this rich man is particularly cruel. They both die. The rich man who lives in the big house, Lazarus, the beggar at the gate, they both die. Lazarus goes to heaven, the rich man goes to hell, or something like that. You can make your own conclusions about where they actually go in the parable. But for the purposes of our discussion, one gets rewarded, one gets condemned. The rich man looks up, and he sees Lazarus, called in Abraham's bosom, which we're going to think of as something like heaven. So he looks up at Lazarus in Abraham's bosom, and this is what happens then. So he called him. The rich man called to Lazarus. called up there to where Lazarus was. He says, Father Abraham, have pity on me and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue because I am in agony in this fire. But Abraham replied, Son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things while Lazarus received bad things. But now he's comforted here and you're in agony. And besides all this, between us and you is a great chasm that has been set in place so that those who want to go from here to you cannot, nor can anyone cross over from there to us. So this is what the rich man said. The rich man said, "Then I beg you, Father, send Lazarus to my family. Send Lazarus to my family, for I have five brothers. Let him warn them so that they will not come to this place of torment." And Abraham replied, "But they have Moses and the prophets. Let them listen to them." "No, Father Abraham," he said. "But if someone from the dead goes to them, then they'll repent." Abraham said to him, "If they don't listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be convinced, even if someone rises from the dead." Now, you've probably heard this story before. I've heard this story before. Probably dozens of times, maybe hundreds of times. You know this story. But here's something that strikes me through all of this parable that I'd never thought about before. Here's the rich man, he's got it all together, and Lazarus is the poor beggar. In the afterlife, their situations are reversed, right? All of a sudden, Lazarus has got everything, the rich man's got nothing, but the rich man seems completely oblivious to this. Like he doesn't realize what's going on. Here's three things that kind of point that out. Three things we need to notice about the rich man. Number one, he still treats Lazarus like his water boy. He thinks Lazarus is his servant. "Hey, Abraham, send Lazarus to do this for me." He still thinks he's the rich man. Number two, he strongly implies that God has not given him or his family enough information about the afterlife. If only we had known. Somebody should have told us this. I mean, if somebody just told me, of course I would have been nice. Why didn't you just tell me? I mean, there's an astonishing amount of blame and denial and spiritual blindness here. He says, "If I had known, I would have changed." Like somebody should have told me that. Finally, third thing. What's the name of the rich man? He doesn't have a name. It's almost as if his entire identity was wrapped up in being wealthy rather than being in God. And so once he has no wealth, he's got no identity. Without his money, he's a nobody. He's a nothing. He has no sense of who he was. So that's the rich man. And here's what's really shocking about this story. The shocking part, at least not the most shocking part, is not that a greedy man went to hell. And we talked about this in the high school class this morning. The shocking part is not that the greedy man went to hell. To me, at least. The shocking part is that a loving God went to such extraordinary lengths to keep that from happening. That's the shocking part. I mean, human beings like you and like me, we are created in the very image of God and given every opportunity, and instead we choose daily to reject Him, to ignore Him, to openly thumb our nose at Him, to just put Him on a shelf and put Him out of sight, out of mind. And what does God do about it? Does He get mad? Does He just blow the whole thing up? Not at all. What God does instead was to send His own Son to die for us so that, number one, we might know how much He loves us. Number two, we might understand the desperation of our situation. That's His response to our being complete and total jerks and idiots. That's God's response. The sad and tragic part is that God does not condemn us to hell. God does not condemn anyone to hell. The sad and tragic part is that we condemn ourselves despite His efforts. Whatever your view of hell is, and I'm right, but you can think whatever you want. You can think whatever you think it is. It is just where we're headed if we're allowed to complete a life of self-centered living. Completely shut off from love. Completely shut off from mercy and joy. Completely shut off from giving and receiving. Completely shut off from anything good and everything good. That's sin sort of blossoming, coming to fruit. And the question for you and I this morning, we've put God's moral character on trial here this morning. And I realize this is a serious question and that it is a real barrier to faith for many. But many of you, or most of us here this morning, are already believers. So we've kind of found a way to grapple with this. But nevertheless, I want us to sort of look at ourselves under that microscope slide and examine and see, where exactly am I headed? What kind of life have I been leading? Yes, I became a Christian years ago. I put on Jesus Christ in baptism. I had my sins washed away. I rose to walk in this new life. But you know, funny thing is, my new life looks a whole lot like my old life. And that's not the new life Jesus promised. I'm ready to reach a different destination. I'm ready to walk in a new life. If we can encourage you, pray for you, lift you up, or help you become a Christian this morning, we want you to do that now while we come and stand and sing.
There's a fountain.